Welcome to What Makes a Successful GIS Project Implementation. I'm Glenn Berger. I work in our professional services organization at Esri, and been in the industry for a long time as a project manager, project leader on different projects, focused primarily in our federal space, but have had background in utilities and telcos and you name it. Jerry?
Jerry Clancy. I'm in also professional services. I'm out of our Washington, D.C. office. You'll have to excuse me. I have a bit of a losing my voice already. I've been with Esri about 28 years, which is kind of crazy, in professional services, in a variety of both commercial projects as well as large federal and local state projects. So between the two of us here, we've probably hit on a lot of domains. So we've seen the good, the bad, and the ugly. And what we're going to try and do today is talk a little bit about the good, the bad, and the ugly without naming names and giving you some ideas about what we see that works and how things have changed, because things have changed a lot. So that's what the class is going to be about.
Yeah, and I guess as we go through this, please feel free to stop us in the middle, ask questions, add your own user stories, and share your battle scars, if you will. I think there's a lot of value in that as well, as opposed to just me and Jerry sharing our experiences. So if there's anything you feel like sharing, question you feel like asking, don't wait, don't be shy, raise your hand.
Let's switch places. You stand over this side.
Okay. See, this is the way it typically goes. We start, and then Jerry starts telling me all this stuff to do.
Hey, it's good project management.
That's right. That's right. So we've done this.
Was it six years?
Maybe about 6 years now. And about 6 years ago, it was, hey, you know, we have this great technical conference, but there's a lot of people that come out that are project managers or project leads, or even if they're not in that area, they want to kind of get some insight into, like Jerry said, our best practices, or they just want to hear that somebody else is experiencing maybe what they're experiencing. They want to hear how maybe we have dealt with challenges and just kind of share, if more than anything. You'll see as we go through our slides today, there are some other sessions that you may be interested in that kind of deal with project management, project leadership requirements, gathering, those types of things. So we'll try to reference those.
So is it on?
This is not a technical session. If you're expecting that, you're in the wrong room. If you look at this, right, everybody that participated in plenary and maybe you've been down and you've been to other technical workshops, you've walked through, you've seen just some amazing technology, amazing functionality. And as you look at this, you see, you know, just some tremendous solutions that have been built out, incredible rich visualization, analysis, you name it. But really what I wanted to use this slide for is to emphasize, you really don't see up there the products and the IT that goes into building this. Now, that doesn't mean they're not incredibly important, and we'll talk about that. But I guess I wanted to start with the key part about this slide is it's focused on real business solutions, right? It's not just about, well, what is the technology we're going to use and how do I deploy this technology into the cloud? Those are all valuable things. Those are things that you need to be aware of. But even though we're going to go through 10 things today, and we always say there's no level of importance or no implied, hey, number one is absolutely number one. For me, we both have our favorites, and we'll see if you can figure out which one that Jerry's real excited about. But for me, it's all about the business value and why are you actually doing the project? The technology is absolutely required. The project management is absolutely required. But do not lose sight of that business value. So I wanted to start off with this one to transition into Well, what does it mean to identify that business value? What does it mean to share that vision and those objectives? This isn't, as a project leader, this isn't a speech you have with yourself standing in front of a mirror, right? This is a communication, a conversation that you're having with your stakeholders, with your end users, with the people that are entrusting you as a project leader or a project manager to deliver real business value. And some of the things on here, obviously, you would be surprised at the number of projects that we get involved in, that was perfect, that we get involved in where we go in and we start working with the project team and we say, okay, so tell me a little bit, what's the driver behind this project? Why are we doing this? What's the end game? What's the objective? And it's amazing how many different answers we'll get, or it's amazing the lack of answers we'll receive. We'll receive answers that are, well, let me show you my project schedule. Well, I've got this long list of requirements, but that's not what I'm trying to get at here. What I'm trying to get at is, what does the future look like? How do you have that conversation with your stakeholders? How do you tell that story to the enterprise and to the organization to keep people focused on that? Because later on, when things go south, and they inevitably will, the question is how far south, you've got to have something to fall back on. When you have that discussion with a stakeholder or that user that sits over in the corner and says, darn it, I want to do it the way I've always been doing it. I just want you to rebuild the software to do that. You can begin to have that conversation and say, well, how does that match to the business value and the vision we're trying to accomplish and that we originally laid out on the project? So describe that future. Get that buy-in from the stakeholders. This is going to be a great arbiter, if you will, as you go through the project to kind of deal with scope creep and those types of things.
Yeah, because in these challenging times of budget constraints and time constraints, when you have to prioritize what gets put in your system, this should be the driver to tell you what's going in. So we get all the time these long list of requirements, and you're never going to get them all in the system. How do you prioritize and decide and work with your user community to figure out? This should drive it. If it's not driving to clear business need and function, why are we doing it? And we've got some slides later that kind of talk about how you figure some of that out.
Yeah, I mean, actually going through the process of identifying some of this, you know, how does, if the main driver is we need to improve our customer service numbers, or we need to reduce our O&S costs, or we need to reduce our maintenance, our technicians' maintenance time by some factor, right? That should always be the discussion you have with that questionable requirement, right? Well, how does it support that mission? How does it? And it just helps that conversation. Talked a little bit about business value, obviously, on the previous slide, and engaging and describing and telling the story. But really the key to that is, and the key to taking that to the next step, is not just engaging with the stakeholders, right? I mean, that's obviously important. You got to keep those guys happy. They're typically your funding source. They're the ones that are either going to make your life positive or negative. But really, for us, and I know Jerry speaks to this, and we've user involvement. And when I talk about user involvement, what I'm really talking about is engaging with the users to understand, well, what are their workflows? What are they really trying to accomplish? As you look at, we see programs where somebody will go in and they, right out the bat, they're thinking, hey, desktop, we're going to deploy, you know, we've got these capabilities that are in the desktop, so therefore we're going to deploy a desktop tool set. But then when you engage with the users, next thing you realize is a lightweight web app may be the most appropriate tool set to put in their hands. Or for part of their workflow, if we expose part of their workflow as a lightweight web app, then maybe we can achieve more value, reduce costs, improve their overall workflow. So Too many times we'll get engaged where we say, well, do we have user involvement? Who are our users? How are we working with them? How are we bringing them into the process? And what scares the hell out of me is when that conversation goes into, well, I've got a spreadsheet of everything they told me 6 months ago. We gathered these requirements. Now, I'm not saying that's not a piece of the puzzle, but it is only a piece of the puzzle, and you got to have the context of how, because the users aren't going to use a list of capabilities. The users are going to use workflows and tools that are structured in such a way where it fits within their daily activity. And most of the time when you sit down with the user community and you say, hey, I'm going to give you this, or I think you need this, most of them are going to go, sounds good. Whether they're going to use it or not, they're going to say, well, why would I tell you no? So you got to get into that user workflow, have that user engagement, get buy-in early. It's not something you're plopping down on their desk that final day of system test and saying, go forth and use it. So get that engagement. Smart planning. I know everybody in here that's in project manager or project lead, you know, does this, and everybody's on top of it. I'm sure Jerry does it. You know, she probably does it in her sleep. I guess some key takeaways here. This doesn't just magically happen, right? And that's another thing we sometimes see that, you know, yeah, well, you know, I really didn't have time to plan everything out fully because we had to start. Once again, another thing that scares me. Once again, something I've been guilty of. So resist that, right? Incur the pain up front. One thing I'll touch on here in a few minutes is at some, you know, we're trending more and more to agile, evolutionary type approaches. That's another thing that people seem to kind of use as an excuse why they haven't done planning, which is crazy because anybody that's worked in Scrum or Agile or what have you, the planning, the amount of structure you have to put around that to be effective is as intense as any other project planning activity. Getting that project rhythm down early in the project is extremely critical, especially for large programs where you might have multiple teams, right? So I guess the biggest thing here is don't put it off to, well, I'll do my planning later. I've got to get started. I just got my funding. Let me go. Even if it makes you unpopular at the beginning of the project, even if your stakeholders are beating you over the head with, well, where are we? When are we going to be done? What have you deployed for me today? You've got to make sure to get this done up front. Otherwise, that ship begins to go way out of control, and it's almost impossible to get it back. You'll pay for it later. You will do it later. But if you don't do it up front and you do it later, it's probably going to cost you about twice as much time, energy, and effort.
Yeah, and we tend to see two extremes when we get involved in projects that are not going well. On the planning front, there's none, or it's way over the top. So one of the aspects we see when we ask, where's the project plan, when we get brought in, how we know what we're doing, and if we get a 3.5-inch binder that's their WBS in Microsoft Project that's down to the minutiae of quarter hours of how they're doing things, that ain't smart planning. That's just gone to the other extreme. At the same time, as Glenn said, on a lot of agile projects we get brought in for, they say, well, we don't plan, we're agile. That's totally bogus. Do not accept that as project managers. So we tend to see the extremes of these things, and the art of project management is finding the balance for that project about what is enough. And there's some really good guidelines at the end of kind of books that we use in terms of what does enough mean. But if you do not do this right, the two characteristics of projects that don't go well, they did not plan well, and they did not do their requirements correctly. Gather their requirements correctly. So those two things will torpedo a project time and time again. You see it all the time.
And planning, you know, the first bullet on here, I kind of just skipped right over that. But planning is a team sport. And, you know, another thing we sometimes have a tendency to fall into is, as project leads or project managers, we got those stakeholders beating us over the head or saying, hey, where's your project? Where are we? Why aren't you delivering? Why haven't you done this yet? And we have a tendency sometimes to say, okay, well, let me start moving stuff around. Maybe I can cut this time. I can tweak this. That can't be done in a vacuum, right? You got to bring your developers into this process of planning. You got to bring your customers into this process. You got to bring your users in. So it is a team sport. Now, there's appropriate planning events that you want to have all those players involved. You may not want all those players in every planning event or activity you're doing. But the key thing is, make sure this isn't something that just you as a project manager or a project lead is doing, because otherwise it's going to be really hard to get people to fight for that plan or to share that vision. So we've had a bunch of different graphics that tell this story. And I saw you took my car out of
here. I did.
So as we talk about staying focused on what's important, maybe some of you have seen this, it's kind of a well-known study, but we've been using this for a couple years now because it's pretty amazing when you sit back and you look at the data that's being represented here and presented here. When you look at this, essentially what it's saying is, out of all the, they surveyed a ton of, and you can go on and look at, it's referenced in the slides, which everybody will get the slides. Go in and look at the study to kind of get the full detail behind it. But the key takeaway here is, out of all those requirements that you go through on a program or a project, over 60% of those, based off of surveyed users and programs that work after the fact, over 60% of those were never used. That is a tremendous waste in effort, energy, when we're all trying to deliver on tighter time frames at lower cost. Now, it doesn't mean don't do requirements, right? Jerry would slap me upside the head if I even said such a thing. What it means is, how do you focus on that sweet spot, that 20% of often or always? You've got to get that first. You got to get that first. And over time, so there's a couple reasons why that 64% never or rarely used. Project lasted a long time, and over time, the business changed. The business drivers and value wasn't there anymore, but they couldn't adjust. They weren't agile enough to say, well, let's adjust. Oh, I did that, sorry. In other cases, right, it might have been requirements or part of the system that was in the old system they were replacing, and they just thought, well, we had it in the old system. We certainly need it in the new system. So there's a whole host of reasons for that. But you want to focus on the 20% and really try to hit that sweet spot. And then over time, you want to make sure you have a process, you have a rhythm, you have a methodology that allows you to minimize that 60%+ that's never or rarely used. You're going to go through, I mean, let's face it, right? You'd like to always say you're 100%, everything you build, everybody's using, everybody loves it. That's not probably reality. Because people come to discussions around requirements and such with their own agendas. And no matter how much we try to keep it tied to the mission or the value, sometimes it's difficult. Somebody gets a requirement through there. We end up working on it forever. Next thing you know, nobody uses it. But you want to minimize that and get it as low as you can. Jerry always talks about, and kind of uses, you know, when you start engaging with those users, when you start engaging with the people, whether it's your users or customers or whatever the case may be, to really kind of keep saying, well, what are the top three things that you need? What are we really trying to, what are we trying to do, and what are the top three things you believe are necessary to accomplish that business value or that mission value, right? And keep, you know, not Where's your list of 300 things, and let's pare it down to three. It's let's talk about the three, and then we'll build it up as time requires.
That's really hard to do. I mean, we often get these long lists of the system shall ... and there's 500 of them. And as you kind of figure out how to build those into workflows and you start mapping out, we do a lot on whiteboards, and yellow stickies are the best project management tool. You don't need high-end systems. We definitely use them, and they have their place. But you can do a tremendous amount of work with yellow stickies. And requirements should fit on those yellow stickies. And you know, some of the techniques we use in trying to get to some of that, you will get 300 yellow stickies up here. How do you find the 20% on this board that really, really matter? And there's a bunch of techniques we use in terms of getting people to come up and saying, okay, what's the top 20 here? Don't go to number three right away. What's the 20 that you have to live with, and give each people different colors, and they put dots beside things? It starts to resonate really quickly. What's the ones that have no dots on? That's in your 64%. And then once you've said that's the top 20, what's the top 10? Give them a different color. We used to play, Jack does this all the time within Esri requirements gathering. We call them Jack dollars or Jack bucks. If I have $100 to spend, where am I putting that $100? You can do the same technique with these types of things and say, okay, if you're putting your $100 on this requirement, it's in the 20% you're going to use every single day. And there's different ways you can try and do that without being too challenging. Don't go straight to, of all these 300 requirements, what are the three you can't live with? try and get them to, and what happens is you'll start to see clusterings happening. And you'll start to see the dots coalesce, and there'll be a discussion about trade-offs happening. That's where you need to get to. This doesn't mean that the 64 up here that don't have any dots are useless. They're just a lower priority. They're not going to be done really fast early on. But you recognize them. They've got ownership up here, someone's name against them, and then you can kind of file them over here, and then as soon as someone starts to say, hey, that one over there I really need, you can start have a discussion back about how you bring that back to the table. But you can't build, there's no budget anymore, there's no time anymore to do all of these 300 things. You have to find techniques and ways to engage with your clients to get to the 20%. Okay? It's really a challenge. There are great techniques, we can talk to you about how we do it, but it is one of your project management challenges, is how to figure out, how do I get to that 20%?
And there are some... You know, there are some really good business analysts that know how to do that well. We find ourselves, right? The old day, I know years ago we used to work on projects where you had project manager, and then you had these business analysts that were domain or requirement experts that would engage with the different users. A lot of that stuff we don't see that anymore. However, so we find ourselves as project managers, as project leads, having to put that hat on and having to figure out, well, how do I do that myself? And some of us are very good at managing the programmatics, the PMO type things. So, yeah, we try to lay out a few strategies here or ideas to consider in this area. So always over the past, I guess, 2 years, I've been asking this question. If I could see just a count of hands for the number of people that are involved in agile projects, you know, Scrum, some type of evolutionary. Okay. So, you know, it used to be 6 years ago, we had the one guy in the back that said, well, I am, and it's the greatest thing in the world, and let me tell you why. I think it's becoming more common. We're starting to see more and more of this. And I don't mean to imply with this slide or our discussion that we'll have here in the next few minutes that, you know, hey, you go agile or you go evolutionary and you solve all your problems, right? Because that's not the case. It takes a lot of structure, takes a lot of focus.
And great team.
And a great team. And but I would say, for me, it allows you, or you're investing in the right places, right? You're still doing a fair amount of administrative activities, but you're doing the stuff that matters. You're documenting the stuff that matters. You're not just building documents to put them up on a SharePoint site and have them sit there forever. So, you know, somebody just says it's something that's done and we can refer to it. You're building stuff that matters. You're bridging that gap between the developers and the users in a very timely way. So let me talk a little bit about it. For those that may or may not know it, and I'm just going to kind of cover it at a high level, it is a great approach for what Jerry was just talking about, which is, you know, how do you get to that 20%? How do you keep people focused on the 20% of valuable requirements and let those other requirements kind of hang out by the wayside and maybe fall to a lower level of priority? So starting in the upper left, I mean, you'll see here we have requirements. You'll hear us mention user stories, capabilities. We kind of use those somewhat interchangeable in this discussion, even though they're not exactly. But in the upper left is essentially that what we refer to as the product backlog, or those list of all those sticky notes that Jerry was referring to, right? The 300. Here's what I want to do. I need this capability. I need this function. I need to be able to do this. And let's assume you've met with the team and maybe you've weeded some of those out. Maybe you haven't. All of those go into your product backlog. Now, all of those should have a reason. They should be written from the perspective of the user. As such and such user, I would like to be able to do this. And here's the business value. Here's what I'm going to do with it. And those get entered in at different levels of detail over the course of the project. But then you have this concept of a sprint or a very fixed time box level of activity that says, okay, customer, all 300 of them are in this list. You got for the next 2 weeks, the next 30 days, what do you want the team to be working on? Right? Do you want them to be working on some obscure requirement, or what do you need to make sure is ready right away? What's the thing that the executive is going to look at you and say, where is it? I want to see this new functionality. I want to see how we're delivering a reduction in O&S costs. I want to see how we're improving our customer service. So the customer is constantly ranking and prioritizing what goes in that funnel, what user stories they're going to pull off the backlog and get it assigned to the team. So the team is working on that for the next 2 weeks, 30 days, typically no more than 30 days. So what you see here is a sprint cycle of 30 days or less, right? Now, right now I'm working on a project, we're working 2 week sprints, and
it's a fast tempo. It is a fast tempo 2 week sprint.
Yeah. It's wearing me out. But the point is, and why I like this concept and why we've embraced it over the years, is as you look at that sprint, you know, people are kind of taking that one bite of the elephant, one bite at a time. They're not trying to solve or not trying to eat the elephant all in one sitting. It's 30-day increments. What am I doing for the next 30 days? How am I showing that value? Now, the benefit of that is you've got focus. You know, a lot of stuff used to always happen years ago in the last 30 days of a project. So this is essentially always the last 30 days of a project, because at the end of that 30 days, you're showing, you're demonstrating, and you have a release that should be able to be deployed. So this isn't 30 days to write up requirements and 30 days the next sprint to write up a design. This is actually to do further requirements, definition, design, development, unit testing, and potentially deployment in 30 days, right? So you keep the development team focused. Everybody's kind of on board. What are we doing for the next 2 weeks? What are we doing for the next 30 days? It forces prioritization just by the nature of what the program is. Every 2 weeks to 30 days, hey, customer, you can change your mind. You can go in and grab something that maybe is lower on that list. So you don't have the battles that we used to have that, oh, God, if I don't really fight for this obscure function, I'll never see it. Well, you the customer, the stakeholder has an opportunity, and they begin to see that rhythm that every 2 weeks or 30 days they can voice their opinion and they can say, but this is a priority for me. Let's get it queued up. So that's nice. Also, from the standpoint of it really begins to also focus on the things that matter. When you get down to a 2 week or a 30 day cycle, all of a sudden people start asking questions of, now, do you want me doing this? Or do you want me developing and coding this particular requirement or capability? You very quickly begin to determine what are the things that matter, what are the things that can go by the wayside because they're not adding value to the project or the program. Anything else? Right after lunch,
in this room,
there's a how to utilize Agile for GIS projects, and they'll get into this in much
that
lower
one
level.
One slide will have 30 slides behind it. So.
Correct. So if you're interested in what I was just kind of laying out, then great session for that.
Yep. Pass the baton.
I'm passing the baton.
Okay. Let me move over that way.
Yeah.
Okay. So, this will be my foot stomping slide. Fundamentally, one of the reasons, I believe, the biggest reasons that projects don't work is they have not done a good job of gathering the requirements. They were incomplete, they were unclear, there's too many, there's no priority, there's no business value, you name it. But requirements to me are fundamentally, when we get called into projects and I see the documents or lack of documents around it, if you do not have a good process to gather requirements and feed in change to those requirements, you are setting yourself up for a miserable project. So what does that mean? Requirements gathering, as Glenn alluded to, we see RFPs all the time with an appendix at the back with 400 pages of spreadsheets with line after line item of requirements. That is a start, but it is not the end all of requirements. We fundamentally look at requirements as how do users use, when I go in and use a system, I have workflow. So if I'm a urban planner in a field and I'm doing some zoning analysis, what is the workflow that I'm going through to get there? You know, and it's stringing those 300 requirements that we've gone on separate line items into a workflow that makes sense so that I can take it to my developers and say, this is how they kind of want to string them all together. And there's no ambiguity about how that stringing together happens. So we use a lot of different techniques in terms of gathering at that product backlog. If I go back to this slide, you know, this is where we would do in some small workshops with people focused on yellow stickies, user stories. We use the term user stories a lot. There's some books at the end of this presentation that are nothing to do with GIS, just really good software development practices that a lot of people use that type of concept. It's a user story. It's a focus on what the user's doing. It says business value. Once it gets dropped in here from a requirement standpoint, you have a chance to expand upon it. So this might be very large user stories that you break and decompose into smaller and smaller and smaller pieces of workflow. Okay. We generally go from that general to the specific. So there should be, at some stage, the detail and minutiae about exactly the performance requirements that they're expecting are tied to those, the acceptance testing that should be tied to that. But we're not at that level when we're at the beginning of putting everything into that siphon and figuring out requirements. It is certainly not a long list. It is also not about, we would see requirements that says, I want to make a map with ArcMap. Well, ballyhoo, good for you. That ain't a requirement. That's telling me how they want to make a map. There should be most requirements should be completely technology agnostic. You shouldn't have any Esri products or names listed on your requirements. User doesn't know. User shouldn't care. In this day and age of when you're putting more and more into these apps type things, They don't know I'm in Survey 123 or I'm in Workforce or Collector or ArcMap or Pro or whatever you're using. That's the how. It's not the what. Requirements should focus on the what. Now, when the technical staff get hold of those, they're going to be scratching their heads and say, okay, is this someone going out into the field? It's a mobile app. Is it more appropriate that it's more analytic and it's a desktop app? They're the ones who are figuring out the how, but the requirements should not dictate that. The requirements should be focused on business value and workflow in the user language. So it shouldn't be things like projection information and all sorts of things that are very techie from an ArcGIS standpoint. I should rephrase that and say that some of the requirements can be quite technical. So if you're in utilities and there's very specific terms, it should be in the terms of the user, not the terms of the GIS tech analyst. So the poles and the utilities and the lines and all the things that I don't have the right names for should be in those requirements because that's how the user thinks about arcs, lines, and polygons. It shouldn't be arcs, lines, and polygons in there unless they talk that way, okay? In addition, you want to be thinking about early on, how do we trace back and how do we do acceptance on these? Even in agile processes, you need to be thinking about testing and acceptance. It just doesn't happen by itself. And so badly written requirements lead to badly designed systems, lead to badly accepted systems, lead to pissed off users that don't use it. I see it over and over again. The challenge you have as a project manager is finding that 20%, really writing those user cases well, and then moving that through to get it in the hands of the users as fast as you can. That's your job as a project manager. Okay? And all the really great things you see at the conference this week, which is a bit of a heresy at a technology conference, doesn't matter if it doesn't provide business value and you really haven't done a good job of articulating why you need it and how it's going to be used for your users. Okay.
There's some really good, and I think we have some of them in the back, but you can just go online and find. There's some really good sources for how to write effective user stories and use cases. So a user story, and I think it probably is in the requirements session.
There's two sessions on this at the conference.
Just so you know, this is the one that Jerry's really excited about, requirements.
So, requirements. Don't get me started on that. This room, right after the Agile one, it's a whole session on requirements. So this one slide, there'll be 45 slides on how we do requirements gathering.
And they go into user stories,
and they take and kind of walk you through that process. So this is the project management room for you guys. They're also repeating that same session tomorrow if you can't go today in a different room, but that's being repeated. But it is, if you're interested in this and you're thinking about how to move your practice forward and how to be more effective, requirements gathering fundamentally is at the heart of successful projects. Okay? Okay. This may seem like a really simple thing. Design components together. Woohoo! But I can't tell you the number of times that I've been involved and got brought into projects where they've had some big group meetings like this to kick off the project. And then all the teams, the database team went that way, the app team went that way, the IT team went that way, and they didn't talk again for 3 months. And the database team went off and designed a wonderful database that doesn't support the applications because they went to third normal form of beautiful database design, but it doesn't perform well. The IT team went off and did their thing. The app people went off and did. It's a bit extreme, but I have seen it happen. More than you would think. So this whole idea of an integrated team bringing people together from different places in an agile project, you are forced this way because in 30 days from the start of the project, you've got to stand something up. So the IT team and the data team and the app team can't go their way. We've got to stand something up in 30 days. How are we doing it? What is the focus we're doing for the next 30 days? What data do I need? I'm not going to solve all my data problems. I'm not going to schema out my entire database for the next 6 months. I've got to stand some data up in 30 days. What are we doing? And your job as a project manager is to keep the team together. And in these days of kind of dispersed development all over the place, which is phenomenal, we do an awful lot, we've got teams all over the place, it is a real challenge from a project management standpoint to do this, because there's a tremendous value in bringing people in the same room and working together as a unit and seeing the issues that other staff are having and being able to just walk over and say, Glenn, where's the schema? What's happening? It's a lot harder to shirk that when you're on FaceTime. Actually, it's a lot easier to shirk that when you're on FaceTime. But the idea of spending 6 months on a database design to get it right, it just doesn't happen anymore. You're never going to get the database design right, because the apps are changing, the business needs are changing, we're going to have to change the database. So how do we make it most efficient? How are we designing all of these components together to make it happen? And that's why this whole idea of agile and 2 week or 4 week sprints really forces this issue. The projects that have not gone well when we've got involved in them and have been kind of long projects, and the teams were dispersed and they weren't talking to each other. They were off doing their own great designs, but when they were bringing them back together, they weren't working. So the earlier you can bring things together in those central teams, the better. Okay, we used to have this slide saying, change happens, get over it. And we thought that might be a bit rude. It was a bit rude.
Factual.
But it's true. Change happens. I have had every single one of these bizarre statements happen to me in a project, including moving to a different OS in the middle of a project. Can we just go to Linux? Do this? Yeah, we could. You know, what's the impact of that? So the idea of change is a tremendously hard one. And in the olden days when we did kind of big projects that were multi-years and they were, 6 months for requirements and 6 months for design, and then change was not accommodated in that because it was contractual, everyone was mad at each other, by the time you started to deliver things, no one liked it anymore, but that's what you told me you wanted 2 years ago. So the agile process has really helped provide a mechanism for change, but it can be pure chaos if you do not manage it. And you've got to have a way to communicate with people and say, okay, this is how new things are going to get surfaced. This is the process and the protocol that we're using. And let's have open forums to figure some of those things out. But the hardest changes on here have nothing to do with the technology. They're organizational and they're people changes. The hardest changes that we see, we always talk about that a system is built of five things: hardware, software, data, apps, people, and policy. It's that last one that is the hardest one to deal with. I've always done my zoning this way. I've always done my editing this way. My form always looks like this. I can do that, but that's custom. That's going to take me 6 months to develop. Can you take a template or an app and use this? That's a hard thing to sell. And in this, the platform, the ArcGIS platform, we have shifted how we build systems completely. We never go to custom first. It's always, what can we do out of the box? And you have to give me a good business reason, unless you've got oodles of money and oodles of time, to do it otherwise. But it's hard. Organizational change, getting people to change their workflow to fit more into a COTS, commercial off-the-shelf model, is really, really challenging. And do not overlook that as you plan out how you embark on planning things, because you will get people who will poison the entire project because they do not want to change. You need to identify those people really, really early and figure out how do you work with them or get them out of the way. I attended a great presentation. It was at last year's user conference from an organization, an international organization, who talked about that. And it was really enlightening about how they figured out who in the organization did not want to change, and they figured out ways to either bring them on board or get them out. And it's ruthless and it's horrible, but That will make successful projects, or it will actually, I've been involved in projects where it's completely undermined the project success. And one of the things you've got to think about is how you do that. And the approaches that you have from an interaction level of, is it one-on-one? Do you have to have regular meetings? How do you do that from a communication style? But it's really, really hard to do sometimes. And it's not just the change in technology. It's really about changing people's minds and hearts and doing things differently, embracing new ideas. And you're going to get a lot of great ideas and vision from this conference. You need to figure out how to streamline that in without scaring your organization, because you need them to embrace it as much as you do to make it successful.
Yeah, I guess just another foot stomp point. Jerry said it, but you know, if you do take an evolutionary or an agile approach, it is planned in. You know, it's all about change. It's all about being agile. So take advantage of that, right? If you feel like that's going to be a particularly mm-hmm. difficult thing for you on your program, or maybe a new initiative you're starting, maybe that's what drives you to go down that path. Because, yeah, pretty much every 2 weeks or 30 days, you're kind of redefining what that next 2 week or 30 day process is going to look like. So, and then you kind of are forced to have those challenging discussions around scope, schedule, budget, impact. And people kind of get conditioned for that, but they also know that they can change.
Right.
They also know that they can drive new opportunities, so they're prepared for that, but they're conditioned for having to back it up and having to really justify why it's necessary, right, and how it's going to help the business.
And one of the things you need to learn as a project manager is you don't want to become Dr. No. No, 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 no. That was used to be the way when we would do projects. No, you can't do that. No, you can't do that. You need to be able to give them the options of yes, but. That's your other mantra of, yeah, we can do that. You know, we are in a sprint right now. There's a sacred rule. You do not change content of current sprint. You can change the future. So, let's have that discussion. If that now is becoming priority number one, let's put it into the hopper. Let's see what we had planned for the other sprints. Let's see what that impact is. And as the key stakeholder, are you going to buy into that? Are you going to help me sell that? Because we're going to have to move printing off to something else. If you really want this in the next sprint, this is how we need to deal with it, and help me within the organization to make that happen. So the other idea is, you know, the communication style you have as a project manager is really critical. And when we talk about open communications, we talk about a number of things. As we kick off projects, we generally do a couple of things. We would generally have some sort of all-hands type meeting, which would be in a room that's probably as big as this. We've had other ones that have been a lot bigger than this. And what is the purpose of that? That is to get everyone saying, we're getting on a train, the train is leaving the station, get on board. And how we would really try and run those types of meetings, we would try and get the highest ranking official that is involved in the project up here saying that. Not us as the consultants, not as the IT department. Who, you know, if you're building a new enterprise system for the city, get the mayor, get someone, you know, the city of LA, that geo hub that's happened, that was a vision from the mayor. When that all started to get kicked off, he's up there saying, departments, we're doing this. Get on board. You want the highest ranking official you can get your hands on up here saying, get on board, here's the train, this is why we're doing it, this is what the business is dictating us, we have to change. Giving those key pain points, identify them early, get them up there saying that, and then get them out of the room. Because no one will talk with the highest ranking official in the room. And we would then kind of have some brainstorming sessions. We do some vision setting. We show a lot of the videos and the demos of what other people are doing. We give people the latitude to think out of the box. So as you saw some amazing things on plenary, maybe you're not a city, so the LA hub thing, the geo hub that was up there, may not resonate with you from a business standpoint. But it's incredibly visionary, as are some of the other ones. So try and pick things in your domain, but also bring things from outside your domain, because I think it really sparks ideas and interest. And if you're trying to make change and really shake your organization up, I think some of the videos that come out of this conference and the ideas that you see can really help that. Once we've kind of got everyone on board and we've got some new vision stuff going, we would never do requirements gathering in a room this size, ever. It's a recipe for chaos. You would break it down into small groups, 5, no more than 10 people at a time. Sometimes you do requirements one-on-one, but you do them in small, manageable groups, and you figure out how to communicate with that group and work through the requirements process. Other communication things, the tempo of an agile process means that you cannot be silent. Silent is an admission that you're on the train and you are on board. Silence means acceptance. But people who are silent on a project, as a project manager, as you're kind of walking the halls, which is the biggest thing you need to do as a project manager, get out from your desk, get out from email, put that phone down, and go out and see people and walk the halls. As you're walking the halls, you need to figure out where's the trust coming from? Who's got the right version of truth here? If your tech lead is saying, everything's fine, we're on schedule, and they're ordering pizza every night of the week because they're working there till 8 o'clock in the evening, it's not on schedule. You know, you've got to be kind of thinking through some of these ideas of how am I communicating? How am I testing the water and the tempo? And in a 2-week sprint cycle, you can't wait for 2 days to figure stuff out. You don't have that luxury because you've just wasted, you know, 20% of your entire cycle waiting for someone to communicate back with you. And one of the things you have to learn as a project manager is not one communication style works for everyone. You know, the style that I communicate with Jack, who owns the company, is very different than how I talk to Glenn.
Yeah.
Well, actually, maybe not so different. But, you know, the open, you know, do they communicate better via FaceTime, via email? Do they want a daily status report? Do they want a monthly status report? Is it every week? What is the style? Is it short, sharp? Is it they want detailed reports? So that style is very, very different depending on who you interact with. And you've got to learn that. And you've also got to learn that kind of intuition of what works and what doesn't work. And it's hard. Those are the kind of soft skills you need to think about as a project manager. But you also need to understand when to say no. Under the Agile, you've got a great process. Once you've laid that process out, you've got the rules laid out, and it gives you the leverage to say, we do not change what's the current sprint. It's cooked. It's what's in there. We're not adding stuff. You can get to change the next one, so let's figure out how to embrace that and say no in a way that continues to make progress and engage people rather than shutting their door. Okay?
Yeah, I guess tempo, just to kind of emphasize that a little bit. One of the challenges that we face, or that I'm facing recently, is the tempo, especially on a 2-week or a 30-day process. You get into a lot of these daily stand-ups, and they're 15-minute meetings. And you might get into a scrum of scrum call if you have multiple scrum teams. And then you get into every 2 weeks or every 30 days, you're doing demonstrations for the customer. And then you may be deploying to a test environment. All of those things account for time that I'm just giving you the heads up. Plan that into your time,
yeah.
Because what we all have a tendency to do, and guilty as charged, we all have a tendency to look and say, okay, I got 2 weeks, I've got this person, that's great, you know, they have 60 hours available or whatever the case may be, so therefore they're going to be doing development for 60 hours. There's a lot of other stuff that's going on in there that you've got to plan for and accommodate. Now, the good part about it is, back to the slide I did earlier about planning up front, if you can get your tempo defined so everybody kind of knows we're going to do a daily stand-up at the beginning of every day for 15 minutes and no more than 15 minutes, that we're going to deploy to a test environment on the second to the last day of the sprint, that we're going to do a demo for the customer, and that's going to be no longer than 2 hours. Those become blocks of time that can be planned for. So you begin to realize, well, maybe it's not 60 hours of available development time. Maybe it's 50 hours of available development time. So the tempo can be your friend, but you've got to establish that tempo. Otherwise, you get a lot of people saying, well, wait a minute, I haven't been able to finish all my work items because I've been in these daily stand-ups, or I'm having to prepare for a demo. Right. All of that should be factored in to that sprint cycle.
And, you know, leading to that, people build projects. We have the best software in the world. That's why we've worked with this company for so long. We fundamentally believe that if you're going to implement GIS, use our platform. But if you don't have the right people, and if you haven't trained them right, and you haven't got the right skills, I don't care how good the software is, it's not really going to get successfully implemented. And we see this over and over again. So it is absolutely critical that you think about, what is the team that I need to deploy and make this project successful? And build that into your expectation setting. So if you're building or you're adopting Scrum for the first time, it is well worth your while to go and find someone who's run a Scrum project before, because it can be chaos. It can be liberating chaos, but it could also be really, really frustrating. If you're looking to embrace those things, get some education on it, figure out how to do it. Do it small the first time. Don't build up your enterprise project as a Scrum project, and that's your first Scrum project, because it's tough. There's a lot of things, a lot of moving parts you've got to think about. In terms of training, if you're going to be doing your first mobile project and you've never done an iOS app before, you got to build some of that in. They've got to have a learning experience in terms of how you deploy things. So on the training is on two fronts. The development team, how do you care and nurture for your development team? There's a tremendous amount of online training that I got announced. It's all free. I don't know that. I got announced at plenary. So a lot of the online stuff is free for customers. You should be taking advantage of that, putting plans together for your teams. If you don't, you're going to have gaps, and you need to figure out how to fill them. The other training is your end users. There's a whole concept of just in time. Don't give them training 6 months before you're deploying something in the field, because they'll have forgotten how to even turn on the device, let alone how to use it. That's a whole strategic plan that you've got to figure out. So the training of those guys needs to be a critical path that you plan for, and also figure out who your early adopters are. One of the things we try and do if we're deploying to really big national type organizations is you don't want to deploy to everyone. You figure out which is the region in that federal agency that's really, wants to embrace it and is really embarking on stuff. And you go work with them and you deploy at them, and then everyone else gets really jealous. There's nothing like jealousy to drive successful projects. We see it all the time. I have a great example of a client who will say unnamed. And we were deploying a lot of things across a lot of regions, and one region would just not give us their data. On two of the other regions, it was pretty bad data. So we said, we're deploying anyway. So we put it up where with the six regions who gave us the data, and the other ones had big blank state maps. And it didn't take very long for their head executive saying, well, why is my region empty? Well, you guys didn't give us the data. So in this time of kind of you can deploy data on a constant basis, do not wait to get it perfect. Get it out there and work with your team to deploy in a training capacity for your end users. But do not forget about the team that you are building and building the systems. Because as we like to say, we've got great software, but if you don't have the right team, it doesn't really make much difference. Okay? So on that, those are our 10 points. We change them. Some of them say the same. Some of them change each year. But these are the general characteristics we see of why projects succeed, and if you don't do them, why projects fail. So I hope that's been enlightening. We'd love to hear some examples of what you guys work through. We also want to hear, we've fought an awful lot for project management related classes here, tech workshops here at the user conference. So the requirements one, the agile one, there's one on how to write an RFP. You know, if you have things you are really challenged with, we want to kind of hear that. Is there a specific process? We're hearing a lot about agile and how do we do it. Is there specific things that we should be looking at? So we really want to hear when you fill in your surveys, and I'll actually got here some additional resources, some books we use. We are not endorsing any of these. Esri doesn't get paid for any of this. These are, most of these are general software development books.
And I think that's key, right? While there are some nuances, obviously, to GIS, you know, mainly you get, you know, you may have a user base that's being introduced to some technology they haven't seen before in some case, but that's becoming less and less. But the key thing here is these are kind of standard IT,
engineering, software development.
So, you know, these same practices, this same information can be used and leveraged for GIS project.
So, and there's a bunch of different links up here as well of things we use, PMI, the agile process, different kind of blogs that we reference a lot in terms of how we continue to learn and drive things. Because one thing I've also learned as a project manager, your learning never stops. Things are changing so constantly. You have to stay on top of how you grow your practice and how you grow your art of managing projects. So these are just examples.
I did want to point out the top link. That is something, just FYI, that I'm starting to see a lot more of in the federal cluster. Government space, the scaled agile framework. And that one in particular, just we used to get a handful of questions about, well, how do I use agile on a big enterprise project? You know, that is a framework or a methodology to try to address that. Once again, not endorsing it or whatever. It's just we're starting to see it being a little bit more common and how to deal with larger agile projects.
Surveys, if you've got the event, fill in your surveys. We really want to hear, believe it or not, the weekend after this conference, all the surveys get looked at and there's a lot of critique. What worked, what didn't, who had full rooms, who didn't. They're not going next year if the rooms aren't full. But what is else on your mind? What else do you need to drive successful projects? If you've got issues, put them on the survey. They get read. We get pulled in on a planning meeting that starts next week on next year's user conference because it's hard to fight for these rooms. And so we appreciate when people have done that in the past and filled in surveys and given us their feedback because we've had a great response from users and also learned a lot from them.
I mean, it started with this session six years ago. Now we have requirements, discussions, and agile track. So share that in your survey. If there's something in particular you're interested in or, hey, I sure would like to see this, put that in there because people do read those and that will help get some of those things.
Great. And our email's up there. Yeah, comments? Yep.
I have a question.
No, we've got our email's up there. Feel free to reach out to us. If we can't answer your question, we'll get you connected with the right people.
And you just do the survey. Maybe y'all have already been doing this, but you just get access to the survey
through the events app.
Through the events app, and once in there, you find this session, and then you fill out the survey associated with that.
Sorry, she just let her. Yep.
Yep.
Okay. Yep. Yeah. So it's the same process as apply. Yep. You know, one of the we don't have the diagram here, but you've probably seen that diagram. It's on main stage. There's apps, the portal, and there's stuff at the end. You know, one of the things that we do very differently these days, we used to start with, what's your data? Give me the list of the attributes, and we'd start down at the bottom of that diagram. We never do that now. We start at the top, and no matter what you do, you should start at the top. The data only exists to support apps and business. So it shouldn't be where you start. So even in an analysis type framework, what am I trying to accomplish? Who are the users? What do they do? How do they do it? And that should drive the entire chain that you draw. And so we always draw that from the top. Yep. Who are the users? What do they do? And how do I support it for the rest of the chain?
Yeah, and those end users could be very advanced end users. They could be, you know, people with, you know, very advanced analytical skills as well. They don't have to be, you know, just general users. But yeah, what are the questions you're trying to ask with that analysis, which will then drive what's the back end data that needs
and
to
the
be there? What is the attribute information? Yeah, and then the architecture, yep. Because I mean, in our case, in my case, I run into that a lot, where there's a lot of, hey, we want to have a web editing tool, or you know, maybe they want a high-end desktop editing tool, but the server is across the country in a different data center sitting in the cloud. Well, there's implications to that. So understanding what the users want to do and that intended use, and then from that flowing back into, well, what do I need to have to support that end use? Like Jerry said, we used to start at the data. Let me build this big, rich data thing. I'll get all this information, and I'll spend a couple years getting there, and then I'll figure out how that's going to serve the mission. Really, the mission or the objectives, and I know I say a lot of business objectives and whatever, but it's really what you're trying to accomplish should drive that back in instead of the other way around.
Did you have a... Sorry.
Yeah, no.
Well, I mean, so if the business value is saying, I mean, I'll use an example that's totally unrelated to that. We had met with users, we created what was their business need. They wanted to be able to go out and grab data out in the field, the latest they can get, bring it in, do a bunch of analysis with it. We met with other pieces of the organization, they didn't have the data, and the IT people said, no outside access on the internet. So it's the same idea of if you don't have something, how do you resolve it? You need to go back to your business objectives and views. If that's what your business is about, how do you find the data? How do you make it? How do you resonate and put crowdsourcing apps up? How do you, if that's what your business is about, you need to change the way you interact to figure out how you go get it. Okay. Did you have a question? Yeah, at the end of the user conference, all of our slide presentations we host up, and you will get, when you register your email, you'll get a link to all the presentations that are available that got posted. Now, some people don't post them. We do post ours, but any session that you did go or didn't go to, there will be available. You'll be able to look under the Esri site, and you'll see all of them. Okay? Yeah, there's a question back. Yep.
First of all, are you talking to like the team for review, or are you talking like get it out there? And then second of all, what is kind of your, so I'm definitely a perfectionist. It took me probably way too long to make apps.
Okay. Right. So this perfectionist said, how could you set something out that's not perfect? And getting, you know, part of the method of Agile is there is time constraints. You have to make a business decision at the end of your sprint, whatever it is. Is it good enough to get it out to the users? I would say things are never complete. The database is never complete. I never like the UI the way it is. But if you wait to get it absolutely perfect, you're never going to get the feedback that you really need. It's all in your head. You know, so you need to get it out in front of users as quickly as you can, so that you get that feedback. And I mean, one of the things you need to do, you need to harden up as a project manager. It's not personal when they say it sucks or I don't like it. You know, it's your first attempt, but you need to give them set the expectations and say, look, we've taken some data, we've taken some templates, we've poured stuff in. Will this work for you? And you'll be surprised that half of them say, good to go.
Well, and it really gets, you know, don't let perfect be the enemy of good,
yeah.
Right? In other words, it's got to work, right? I mean, it's got to be the 80%. You can't, you know, because you only get so many times to put something out there. And if you put it out there and it totally craps out, right? Obviously that's
not good.
Yeah, it's a risk that you've got to kind of weigh based off of your environment. But for us and with Agile, it's so important to get it out of the hands of the project team and get it in the hands of users so they can say, you're getting it right, you're heading in the right direction.
And
you may spend a tremendous amount of time getting it to 100% or your idea of 100%, and they only come to look at it and say, well, this isn't what I want. So it's a balance. It's a trade-off.
Yeah. Okay. We are at time. We're happy to keep questions, but I don't want to hold people because the lunch lines will start to get really long. but we are at time. Thank you so much. Appreciate. If you've got questions, come on up.
Thank you. Yep.
Thank you.